This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this show, scientist Kevin Trenberth on record ocean warming, impacts now and for centuries to come. Then from Stockholm, the Blue Acceleration, 50 ways to kill the sea. It's all oceans this week on Radio EcoShock. Most of the heat from our greenhouse gases have been absorbed by the Earth's ocean. Sea temperatures are rising. Ocean heat content in 2019 was the warmest on record by a big margin. Some say it's four times more than all the energy used by the humans on the planet. That heat will come back to future generations for centuries. It is leading more extreme weather around the world right now, according to scientists. The latest study is titled Record-Setting Ocean Warmth Continued in 2019. That was published in February 2020 in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Science. Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a co-author. Kevin is known as a senior scientist at NCAR, the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. He is currently on leave visiting the University of Auckland in his native New Zealand. From Auckland, Kevin Trenberth, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
Just as an opening shot, why should listeners care if the world's oceans are getting a little warmer?
The world's oceans effectively are the main memory of climate change. So we have increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The dominant one is carbon dioxide, which has increased by more than 40% since pre-industrial levels. And half of that increase has occurred since 1985. And so we've got very good measurements of that. We know that these greenhouse gases trap the outgoing radiation and they produce warming. That warming has all kinds of consequences in terms of things like storms and so on in the atmosphere, drought and heat waves. It also is melting ice around the planet, so Greenland, Arctic sea ice, Antarctica are melting, but it ends up that most of the energy imbalance that is created goes into the oceans. And so the oceans are systematically warmer, and they're the best single indicator that the planet is actually warming. With a warmer ocean, the oceans expand, so that increases sea level. We have completely independent measurements of sea level, and sea level is indeed going up on a regular basis, and the melt of land ice puts more water into the ocean. That also increases sea level, so there's a double whammy for the sea level rise. But the ocean heat content is very steadily going upwards. Most years have been record years. The only exception was 2016, and that was because that was a major El Nino year, and a lot of heat came out of the ocean in that year into the atmosphere, and that's why that created the hottest global mean surface temperature around the world. So 2016 is the warmest from the standpoint of the surface air temperature, but in terms of the heat and energy in the planet, 2019 certainly stands out.
How do we know that this warming in the sea is not just part of a much longer cycle? For example, did the oceans get colder during the ice ages, and maybe they're just warming up naturally now after the ice ages are over?
Yes. Well, I mean, certainly there have been variations in the past. And so a lot of the work which I have been doing is to try to understand why. And so my research has been focused on Earth's energy imbalance and actually tracking the energy flows through the climate system. So even if it's natural variability, it has to have a cause. The changes have to relate to the amount of energy that's going into the ocean or being redistributed within the ocean. Now we can measure that. The other thing we can do, and which we included in this paper, is we can actually track the warming that's going on in the ocean. And so there was very little warming below 300 meters depth prior to about 1980, let's say. And then we could track the warming penetrating down below 300 meters to, say, the 700 meter level. into the early 1990s, and it wasn't until the early to mid-1990s that we could track the heat below 700 meters, and now we're tracking it down to 2,000 meters quite well. We have these new observations called ARGO, the ARGO array. These are profiling floats. They're quite impressive devices. They're quite long, slender tubes, and they have a chamber inside that can be either evacuated, in which case the floats rise to the surface, or filled with water, seawater, and they, in which case they sink. And they do profiles of the top 2,000 meters of the ocean about once a week or thereabouts. And when they're at the surface, they telemeter that information on both temperature and salinity back to space-based stations. And so we can track exactly now the fact that the heat is coming in from the surface and how it's penetrating. And so we can actually watch global warming in action. And, of course, we can do other calculations with models and make measurements at the top of the atmosphere from satellites to indicate what the energy imbalance is. And now we can track where all of this energy is going.
Being humans, we tend to focus on things like losing seafood, which is happening. But let's talk about something else, starting with evaporation. Does a warmer ocean release more water vapor into the atmosphere?
So the warming itself, most of the heat from the sun actually penetrates through the atmosphere. The atmosphere is relatively transparent to the incoming solar radiation and goes into the ocean. There's a certain amount that gets absorbed by water vapor coming in and redistributed by clouds. But the main way the atmosphere actually gets heated is by the evaporation of moisture at the surface and then the release of latent heat into the atmosphere. This is the heat that went into evaporating the moisture in the first place, and it comes back into the atmosphere. And because there's a bit more heat available, it means that the rate of evaporation speeds up a little bit, but also the atmosphere, when it's warmer, can hold more moisture, and the rate is 7% per degree Celsius, or about 4% per degree Fahrenheit. So since about 1970, the oceans at the surface are nearly 1 degree Celsius warmer, and the air above the oceans is about 5 to 15% moister than it used to be. And so all storms reach out and grab the available moisture and bring it into the storm. So it rains harder, or in wintertime, it can actually snow harder if the moisture is coming from over the Atlantic into North America, into Canada, and the northeastern United States. We can actually end up having much bigger snowstorms as a consequence of this. And so this effect is actually larger than the total amount. And so this also affects the frequency of storms. It means you can also get longer dry spells. And in places where it's not raining, one can get more intense droughts and heat waves, and this also increases the risk of wildfire. And so all of these things actually tied together through the warming of the oceans and the extra heat that's available in the climate system. And so this, you know, in the news recently has been all of the bushfires in Australia, tremendous damage and smoke. We're seeing it even here in New Zealand. And so these are the consequences of the global warming.
How can you be sure the ocean is warming overall, though, Kevin, when there are year-to-year differences, like the cycles El Niño, La Niña, where the ocean changes temperature?
Yes, yeah, so we actually track El Niño in recent times quite well. In the distant past, there are enough measurements to help us with this. The measurements, well, after 1970, there were these devices that were deployed from ships called mechanical bathythermographs, and then they were replaced by expendable bathythermographs. So these were devices that were thrown over the side of the ship. They had a copper wire attached to them, and as they went down, they recorded the temperature, and that was sent back to the ship in motion. And so we have these measurements around the world. And we've been able to capitalize on those, given the information about how one measurement at one place relates to measurements at other places and times. And that's enabled us to do reliable reconstructions of what's going on in the ocean back to 1958. 1958 was International Geophysical Year. Now, in the deep ocean, even before then, there were specialized measurements from oceanographic ships. They're relatively few. And so these are where, you know, the ships went out and they actually threw a pressurized bottle over the side and filled it up with water and brought it to the surface and then made measurements, and including the chemical measurements in the bottle. And so although we don't have a lot of these as you go back in time, the changes at depth in the ocean are relatively small and they occur on very large scales. It's not turbulent like the surface with waves and winds causing mixing and things like that. And so it turns out you don't need that many measurements to have some idea that, yes, indeed, we have some confidence that the deep ocean is warming as well, even though we can't reconstruct the patterns around the ocean as well as we can above 2,000 meters now.
More and more, I'm hearing scientists recommend we stop talking about global mean temperature, as the IPCC does, for example, as our measurement for warming and use ocean heat content instead. What is the debate there, Kevin?
Well, they're different things, of course. The surface temperature is where we live, and it has direct implications for agriculture and forest and so on. And so it's very important from that standpoint, but there's a lot of weather variability at the surface. The surface is quite profoundly affected by changes in storm tracks from one year to the next, and some of those are associated with things like El Nino events. And so there's quite a lot of natural variability, or, you know, from a mechanical standpoint, we would refer to it as noise compared with the signal we're looking for in terms of the global warming. In contrast, in the ocean, the signal-to-noise ratio is much, much higher. It's the highest of any measurement that we can make. And the sea level rise is the second highest, not very far behind. And if we want to know whether the planet is warming, the ocean heat content and the sea level rise provide the two best indicators in terms of confidence that the ocean is warming. And in fact, you can confidently say that the ocean is warming with just about 4 years. And then we can say it very confidently. With 4 years of record, the ocean is warming, the planet is warming. And on the other hand, if we want to do it from the standpoint of the global mean surface temperature, we need more like 15 years of data.
So we have heat waves on land. We've all experienced those. Apparently the sea has heat waves as well. What are the impacts of those marine heat waves for living creatures and the ecology?
Yes. So as the ocean warms, the natural variability, some of it's associated with El Nino, but also it's simply chance through the weather. Anticyclones sit in one place for a while, and as a result, the sun shines down, the surface of the ocean warms up, there's less mixing by winds, and you end up with this relatively hot spot in the oceans. We've had those, of course, in the past. But nowadays, when they occur, they break records because they go outside of the previous natural variability. And we're simply seeing more and more of these around the world. Some of them have lasted for as long as a couple of years, but usually they end up wiping themselves out because a hotspot sort of attracts more atmospheric activity above it, ultimately, more convection. And as a result, there's more wind and mixing that goes on, and so it sort of wipes itself out. But then another hotspot is forming somewhere else. So in 2017, one of the hotspots that formed was in the Gulf of Mexico, and that actually led to Hurricane Harvey, which produced prodigious amounts of rain, over 60 inches of rain in Texas. And the subsequent year, the next year, off the coast of Carolinas was where one of the hotspots formed, and that led to Hurricane Florence, again, with very high rainfall amounts, something like 30 to 40 inches of rain in the Carolinas. Perhaps the biggest marine heat wave that's known about was called the Blob. It was actually given a name. You can Google it. And this formed in the North Pacific Ocean in the extratropics, and it lasted from about 2014 through 2015. and had devastating consequences for marine life throughout the entire web, sometimes called the food web. But there were profound effects on the phytoplankton, the tiniest creatures that exist, and also the zooplankton, and these form the food for fish. And so there were profound effects on fish, and several species of fish were really knocked back. The cod, the estimated loss of cod in the North Pacific in those 2 years was about 100 million. 100 million cod were lost. And so up through the chain. So it also affects the marine mammals, including whales and otters and seals. And then, of course, also the birds, the seabirds. And many of these have been documented. You know, the humpback whale, I think it was, where there were estimated that there was over 100 humpback whales lost as a consequence of all of this. And so it affects different species a little differently, but it does tend to propagate throughout the entire ecosystems within the ocean.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Shocking Stuff. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Kevin Trenberth, climate scientist currently visiting the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Kevin is co-author of an unsettling paper reporting the oceans just keep getting hotter. You touched on this, but is the whole ocean warming up evenly? And if not, where is it getting hotter?
It's warming up most places. There are a few spots that it hasn't warmed very much. One of them is just south of Greenland. This is an area which can be affected a little bit by the Gulf Stream as it goes up to Cape Cod and then moves across towards the United Kingdom and up into the North Atlantic. And so variations in the path of that can affect that particular region. And it's also perhaps related to a phenomenon called the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. So it's related to ocean currents within the ocean. And so naturally, as the climate is changing, the winds change a little bit, the ocean currents change a little bit. And so some spots can actually get a little bit cooler. There's not very many at the surface. If you look down below the surface, the most profound warming is occurring over the southern oceans. There's very strong winds down there. Any heating at the surface gets carried downwards and mixed throughout a very deep layer. And also the North Atlantic in general, aside from this region just south of Greenland, because of the cold, dry air that occurs in winter over the continents and then from North America flows out over the Gulf Stream, there are tremendous losses of heat that go into the atmosphere from the Gulf Stream as a result of that. So the strong cooling of the ocean and warming of the atmosphere, warming and moistening of the atmosphere in these regions, and that creates convection in the ocean and carries the surface waters down to much greater depths. And so these days, it's carrying down somewhat warmer water, and we can measure in the North Atlantic that, indeed, this is a place where the heat is penetrating. On the other hand, it's quite different in the North Pacific or in the Pacific in general. And in the tropical Pacific, the top 1 to 200 meters is clearly warming, but below there, in part, it is not. And so this relates in part to the dynamics of the ocean itself. The ocean has very slow overturning circulations, and one of the consequences of this is the vertical structure in the ocean. And so typically in the ocean, you have the top 100 to, let's say, 150 or in some places 200 meters is well mixed and it's connected to the surface and it's stirred up by winds and the temperatures are relatively warm and uniform. But the deep ocean doesn't get affected by this. And in between, there's this region the oceanographers call the thermocline. So thermo is temperature and cline means gradient. And so there's this large contrast. And the thermocline is in part maintained by some of this cooler water from down below that some of it spreads out from coastal regions around Antarctica. Some of it comes from the North Atlantic, and it upwells slowly in other parts of the ocean, And as it upwells, it actually pulls up cooler water from below. And so we can actually see this in action in terms of the changes that we see around the world, that there are some spots where below the thermocline where it has cooled off a little bit in association with these kind of circulations.
So a new expedition is measuring the sea temperature far down below the largest glacier of the Antarctic, Pine Island. I guess that's pretty important to know. And do you think they will find warmer water temperatures down there as well?
They have been finding warmer water down there. One of the really interesting new measurements that has been acquired in the last 10 years or so are actually instruments that are put on the heads of elephant seals. And so scientists have been putting these on, and these elephant seals have got this little hat on their heads. And so when the elephant seals go in the water, they go after fish and maybe chase penguins or something like that. But they're making measurements of places that ships can't go, and we're actually able to track some of the changes that are occurring. Just incidentally, these instruments fall off once a year when the elephant seals molt. And so they're not permanent, and so they don't do any damage. No animals were hurt during this experiment, so to speak. But so we have had indications already that there is some warming, I mentioned before, of the southern oceans. Some of that warm water upwells below some of the ice sheets and the extensions of the Pine Island Glacier out over the, I think it's the Weddell Sea, and also the Ross Sea on the other side of Antarctica. And so it's eroding the ice shelves a little bit from below. And there are a few places where this has occurred, and it's allowed some large ice sheets to break up, and we've ended up with some great big icebergs as a result. But this is really being caused not so much by warming from above, because it's, you know, still very cold in Antarctica and below freezing mostly. It's the warmer water from down below that is undermining some of these regions. And once the ice shelf is undermined and moves away a little bit, then that allows the glaciers to flow more freely into the ocean. And so this is where some of the glacial ice over Antarctica can get into the ocean and contribute to rising sea level.
Quick fact check. Is most of the sea level rise we have experienced already coming from melting ice at the poles or from thermal expansion of the ocean, that is, from the hotter seas we're talking about?
It's probably about 60-40. So most of it does come from the melting of ice and putting it into the ocean. Maybe 40% comes from the expansion of the ocean overall.
If the ocean hadn't absorbed all the extra heat that we're creating with our fossil fuels, Earth would, I guess, already be too hot for humans to survive right now. And that's the good news. But, Kevin, when will all that heat come back out of the sea and for how long?
Some of it gets stored up in places, and in particular in the tropical Pacific, the trade winds and the ocean currents. The trade winds are northeasterlies or southeasterlies in the southern hemisphere, and they create currents which carry all of the warming surface waters across towards Indonesia, north of Australia, and they build up over there in what is called a warm pool. And when the warm water gets so deep over there, 200 meters and more, the ocean sort of says, whoa, too much, and it has an El Nino event. And so this is one way in which the El Nino events come about, and so that warm water then spreads across the tropical Pacific, and some of that heat comes back into the atmosphere. There's a lot of extra hurricane and thunderstorm activity that heats the atmosphere up, and that's why we have the warmest years during El Nino years in the atmosphere, and the ocean cools in the process. So the El Nino is a process whereby it can actually moderate the temperatures a little bit. And so the tropical Pacific hasn't warmed up quite as much as some other regions as a result of this kind of thing. But mostly, once the heat goes into the ocean, the process is pretty well irreversible. The mixing, you know, if you take some hot water out of your hot water tap and cold water out of your cold water tap and mix them together, you end up with warm water and no amount of shaking it up anymore will put it back the way it was into a pile of hot water and a pile of cold water. So you can't get that hot water back in the same way. And so this is a part of the global warming process, that the oceans gradually warm up, sea level continues to rise, and as a result, certainly the surface conditions are somewhat more moderate, but it doesn't come back to haunt us in quite the same way it does during El Nino events. It does mean that the air above the oceans is warmer and moister than it used to be.
The team for this research was led by Li Zhengsheng from the International Center for Climate and Environmental Studies in Beijing. Can we chart out the future direction for warming oceans? Do we know what to expect?
There is, of course, climate models or Earth system models, which include biology and so on, and these are certainly getting better. Having observational estimates as to what's going on helps to validate or to check the veracity of these models, and so the models are getting better, and these are the tools we use to make projections into the future. And so there are projections of, you know, how much ocean heat there is in the future and also sea level rise. And this is one of the very worrying things, because even if we stop increasing the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you know, they're still there and they have a long lifetime. Carbon dioxide has a long lifetime. And so the oceans keep warming up for probably centuries into the future, and sea level continues to rise for centuries into the future. And so even if we do get the global warming under control, there will be some consequences going further into the future.
It's not like if I go down to the beach in Vancouver, I can feel the difference next year. Ooh, the ocean feels a little warmer. It's not like that at all. I mean, the ocean absorbs huge amounts of heat and then it changes relatively slowly. But are there tipping points where bigger, more dangerous systems could be set into motion? Do we know where the limits are?
This is right. I already mentioned that a lot of the warming of the ocean is probably irreversible on a century timescale. If we go thousands of years, then of course we can go back. But from a human lifetime, human generational standpoint, it's essentially irreversible. One of the things that's very worried is that some of these effects could create major tipping points, so-called. We call them non-linearities. And so, you know, suddenly things begin to break or change quite radically. And so the North Atlantic is one area where this is of major concern, the circulation related to the Gulf Stream and this thing called the AMOC. If that changes, then the storm tracks across the Atlantic going into Europe and into the United Kingdom, even if they only shift a few degrees of latitude southwards, and suddenly one region is a lot wetter than it used to be and other regions are a lot drier, and there are profound local effects on climate that may be almost irreversible. And so this is one kind of tipping point that is of a concern. The other kinds that are especially of concern are melting of Greenland, melting of parts of Antarctica, the West Antarctic ice sheet. This relates to this undermining of the ice shelves around Antarctica that, maybe it's already irreversible. We can't stop it and it might keep going. And, you know, if the West Antarctic ice sheet melts, then suddenly the sea level, or not suddenly, but, you know, over a time scale of a couple of centuries or maybe a little longer, the sea level goes up by 6 meters, maybe 20 feet, something like that. And coastal regions are then in great jeopardy. As a result, at the moment, we're expecting that by 2100, sea level will go up by about 30 centimeters, about a foot. But there's a lot of uncertainty attached to that. It could easily be double that, and some people worry that it could be three times that. So it could be as much as a meter rise by 2100. And one way to think about it is that, well, it's not so much what, but when. And so, you know, if we don't get a meter by 2100, we might by 2130. It's sort of sooner or later it's going to happen, and we need to worry about that.
We've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, a leading authority on climate change, often quoted in the media. We reached him at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Find a link to this paper, Record-Setting Ocean Warmth Continued in 2019, in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you again for helping our listeners understand this key science.
You're most welcome. It's a very important topic, and that's why I try to help.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. What are we doing to the sea? Listen to this headline from Stockholm University. Human pressure on the world's ocean accelerated sharply at the start of the 21st century and shows no sign of slowing. Jean-Baptiste Jouffre is a PhD candidate at two respected Swedish institutions. He is the lead author of a massive analysis of the pace and the trends of human impacts on the ocean. The study was published in the journal One Earth. Jean-Baptiste Jouffre, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to connect with you. You're a young scientist who's done a team of people to a major new study. And we know that trawlers drag the sea bottom and wreck it, and miners and corporations, ocean farming. There's just so many ways we use and pollute the sea. What drove you and your team to add it all up, to search for that big picture?
Well, precisely what you just said, meaning recognizing the diversity of human use of the ocean. So there are some iconic use and historical ones when it comes to fisheries, for instance, or navigation and trade. The first globalization really happened when we started sailing to other countries and exchanging goods and commodities with other cultures, nations. But there is an increase of the diversity of uses of the ocean, and that's something that triggered our curiosity to try to understand what we were going into the ocean for.
Well, let's get to a few examples people may not think about. For example, you have a box which describes seabed grabbing. What are you talking about there?
That's an interesting one, because seabed grabbing is often associated, or at least land grabbing is associated with sometimes like illegal practices. In the case of seabed, there's nothing illegal. It comes from an Article 76 in the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea that was signed in 1982, and it's considered the Convention of the Sea, right? So it's a set of articles that regulates what countries can or cannot do when it comes to the ocean. And one milestone of this convention was to establish what is known as the exclusive economic zone. It's 200 nautical miles from the coastline, which is roughly 370 kilometers from the coastline of each country. And that area, that zone, grants exclusive rights to the given country to exploit, explore, manage, and conserve the resources of the water column and the seabed. So in an exclusive economic zone of a country, another country cannot come and fish, for instance, without an authorization or without trade agreement with the given country. And that applies to both the water column and the seabed, so the resources of the seabed and the subsoil. But Article 76 of this famous convention of the law of the sea grants that if a country is able to show, to provide geological evidence that the continental shelf of that country extend beyond the limits of 200 nautical miles, then the country can claim an extended continental shelf that would grant sovereign rights, again, for the exploration and exploitation of resources only of the seabed this time, not the water column, but the seabed beyond the limit of 200 nautical miles.
Well, I think that Canada was part of that process, because I can remember in the 1990s when the cod fishery collapsed off the Newfoundland coast, our east coast, that the Canadian government was trying to keep the Spanish and other countries from still coming and taking the last of the fish, and they sent out, I think, a destroyer or something. And we said, well, we're going to police the ocean far out from our shores, not just the 200-mile limit. And this is happening all over the world. You have published a map that shows that there's very little free ocean left after all the claims are taken into account.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point of this. That's why we dubbed seabed grabbing, in the sense that many countries, it's a total of 83 different countries today since 2000, when the first claim was made by Russia concerning the seafloor below the Arctic. So a total of 83 different countries have actually claimed an extended continental shelf. And every of these claims is, in effect, shrinking what is considered the common heritage of humankind, which is the area beyond national jurisdiction. Now, what the map shows in the paper is both the exclusive economic zones and the extended continental shelf, which adds beyond those 200 nautical miles. And indeed, when you look at the map, you realize that if all the claims were to be granted, because a lot of them are either overlapping or conflicted or pending a decision from the UN body in charge of doing that, then only 48% of the actual seafloor remains shared inheritance of humankind.
And what did you find out about reclaiming new land for sprawling populations in places like China?
So that's a different claim, one of many ocean claims that we looked into and tried to document and quantify over time as well. And it's the one of land reclamation. And land reclamation is finally somehow an old claim. We've been doing that for a long time. And in the Netherlands, for instance, is quite an iconic example of land reclamation. It's pumping out the water from wetlands, for instance, to be able to establish infrastructure. And in recent years, interest has grown for that process in order to expand land into the ocean for airports, for residential area, for industrial area as well. And China, among many countries, in particular, is leading the world in large-scale reclamation projects by extending its coastline 100 square kilometers every year.
So in January 2020, a man named Will Hilton published a key article in The Atlantic magazine. The title is, History's Largest Mining Operation is About to Begin, It is Underwater, and the Consequences are Unimaginable. So who is regulating the rush to vacuum up the seabed for metals? What do you know about that?
Well, that depends. It's yet another ocean claim, which is the one concerning minerals and mining operation. And that the first distinction needs to be made is between mining operations within national jurisdiction and beyond national jurisdiction. So if the mining operation take place within your exclusive economic zones, so within the 200 nautical miles from your coastline, that's the country that is concerned, that is in charge of regulating the industry. Now, if it happens beyond national jurisdiction, in what is referred to as the area with a capital A, and again, which is the same area considered as the common heritage of humankind, then the International Seabed Authority, which is an autonomous body from the United Nations, is in charge of regulating that and ensuring some kind of benefit-sharing mechanisms for redistribution of the profits.
Okay, one other little detail from your paper that I just didn't know about. What are nutraceuticals?
Nutraceuticals, it's a combination of the words nutrition with pharmaceutical. And those are compounds and products that are thought to have health benefits beyond just nutrition. And it's a growing industry. It's a rapidly growing industry. Maybe one of the most illustrative example is the rush for omega-3 that you may see in your different stores when you go do groceries. And a lot of those omega-3 comes from the sea, either from what is called small pelagic, so small fish, or from the krill fishing in Antarctica. And it's a growing industry given the increasing interest in health and nutrition and healthy diets.
Your analysis investigated the growth of offshore oil and gas, water desalinization plants, shipping, cruise lines, and so much more. But some of the impacts on the ocean come from activities most of us would cheer, like offshore wind, conservation, or just gathering more science from the sea. Why count the solutions too?
Well, that's a really good question. It's because the tone of the research is quite neutral in the sense that we did not focus on purpose only on industries, on extractive ocean industries, or only on impacts, or only on solution or conservation of the oceans. What we were really interested in trying to capture was all the hopes and the expectation that humanity has for the ocean. Like, increasingly, we see the ocean as the new frontier for human development. And that doesn't mean only extractive industries. It also means a sustainable future. There is this narrative of the blue economy or the blue growth. And so the blue growth relates to a lot of the industries that are captured there. The blue economy is a concept that, depending on who you ask, you will get a different answer of what it means. And so what we focused on was the trajectory of those trends, meaning the blue acceleration. We were interested in showing that across all those hopes and expectations, they are rapidly and dramatically accelerating over the last 30 years. And that includes both extractive industries with severe impact on the environment, but also efforts to conserve and preserve the ocean, such as the establishment of marine protected areas, for instance, which is also exponentially increasing.
Looking through your paper, and maybe I missed this, but I didn't see acceleration graphs for things like increased underwater noise or plastics everywhere from the surface to the deep. I guess you could keep adding to this study for a very long time if you had the time.
Again, it's a really good point, but it links to the previous comment on how we did not focus specifically on impacts, but rather use of the ocean. So a lot of the plastic that indeed finds its way into the ocean comes from land. And when it comes to noise or light pollution or even chemical pollution, this is some kind of indirect or sometimes direct effect of our uses of the ocean. But the data we gathered and collected was focusing on the direct use of across different sectors rather than the impact of those sectors. But as you said, I think as many graphs as we have now, those trends could be mirrored by an increase in their impacts as well.
And a lot of the graphs seem to show almost going straight up, not quite, but a very straight up motion starting around 1990 or so. Why did this acceleration happen? Do we know?
Well, that's very interesting. And the name itself, the Blue Acceleration, which shows that in spirit of what is often referred to as the Great Acceleration, which is work led by Will Stephan and colleagues, showing that after World War II, there was a rapid increase in both socioeconomic trends and their environmental impacts. Think about the world population that has, for instance, tripled since 1950, or the rate of deforestation, the loss of mangroves and coral cover across the globe. So all those trends have been referred to as the Great Acceleration, which is also one of the starting points that a lot of scientists point to when it comes to defining when did the Anthropocene start. The Anthropocene being the human age, like the time where humanity has become the dominant force of planetary change. And so in the spirit of this Great Acceleration, we looked at the Blue Acceleration, which shows the same trajectory, but with a time lag, as you pointed out, because it starts later. It doesn't start right after World War II. It starts rather at the onset of the 21st century, 1990-2000. And one can speculate of why that time lag, but there are two key mechanisms that may be at play. One of them is declining land-based resources, as simple as that. We're starting to run out of resources or space in some cases, and we talked about land reclamation, for instance, as a solution to solve land scarcity. And so as resources on land decline or become depleted, we're moving into the ocean to find them. And a good example of that is the offshore oil and gas industry. From between 2000 and 2010, 70% of the discoveries of new oil fields happened offshore, rather than on land. Now, the second aspect, which is key, is technological progress. 50 years ago, it was unthinkable to lower down a submarine by 40,000 meters below the surface and start mining the seafloor. We couldn't even think about it. Same thing with marine genetic resources. We didn't have the tools nor the technology to explore the marine realm from the shoreline to the deep sea. And that is rapidly accelerating as well. And so as technology advances, we are able more and more to enter the ocean realm. So I think the combination of technological progress and declining land-based sources, coupled with growing population, meaning growing consumption patterns, and also we can talk about it later, maybe the effect of climate change, which is like opening up new space in the ocean. I think the collectively, those trends are explaining why we see this rapid increase over 30 years now.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is the young scientist Jean-Baptiste Jouffre from the Stockholm Resilience Center. He leads a new study showing the ocean is in danger, and they call it the Blue Acceleration. Your team worries about unknown consequences from this big tidal wave of change, and you speak about possibilities like large and abrupt transitions with persistent consequences. I guess we can't just add up each separate thing and think that we have the total, because these things, they combine and they interact with each other, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's one of the critical points of this work in recognizing the diversity of ocean uses and ocean plains. Because when you see the trajectories, you realize that every sector in isolation is aiming at like a threefold, fivefold, tenfold increase over the last 5 years or 10 years. So there is this idea of infinite growth within each sector. And sure enough, the ocean is vast, but it's not limitless. And so if you start piling up all those trends and all those ocean plains, it's fairly intuitive to understand that it simply won't add up. And there, it won't add up from a resource perspective, but it also won't add up from an interaction perspective. And what I mean with that is that one can expect risk to emerge from the interaction between those claims on the ocean way before we actually run out of the actual resource that we're going for into the ocean. An example of that would be spatial conflicts. You cannot do deep sea fishing, like troll fishing, where you have fiber optic cables or pipelines, or you cannot put an offshore oil platform where you have wind farms and so on. So spatially is the most intuitive to think of. But of course, each of those uses of the ocean having impacts, the impacts themselves might interact with each other and create the perfect storm. And that's a little bit what we're waving a red flag for. We don't know about that enough.
And we can't presume the future will be a straightforward continuation of the past. What are some of the emerging or almost sci-fi ideas that you encountered for using the sea in the future?
Yeah, and that again is critical. It's like, how can we anticipate like how the blue acceleration will unfold, right? It's really difficult. We know it's not a linear process, and experience has shown that predicting the future based on past trend is not successful very often. And so we need to find and reflect on ways to predict and forecast what might happen. There is a lot of work in ocean science that is being done when it comes to climate change or oceanic currents and forcings through modeling. So a lot of data-intensive exercises to model in the future based on different scenarios of temperature. It's used a lot when it comes to climate change, trying to model the impact of climate change on the ocean. And those are really necessary, and we need them, and they are extremely important. But they often miss the social component. They often miss the social in the social ecological system that the ocean is. And so we need different ways as well to incorporate the human component into those models. And so one method that has been used quite a lot when it comes to terrestrial system, a lot when it comes to agriculture and food production system, is what we refer to as participatory scenarios. And they are used to identify and analyze the role of existing, but currently marginal drivers of change in shaping the futures. And so by doing that, it gives an opportunity to the participants to envision a positive future and what they would see the ocean be in maybe 50 years or 100 years. And the interest of those exercises is to bring around the table a wide diversity of actors. It has little meaning to just bring industries, for instance. But if you bring the private sector in several industries with the scientific community, with local communities as well, and sometimes native and indigenous communities, which are really reliant on the ocean, then it gives a really nice outcome where different worldviews and hopes and expectations are put on the table and people try to synchronize them. And so that is something we call upon in this paper that should be done, we believe, for the ocean, as it has been done on land and proven to be quite successful.
And right now, the world's largest banks and investment institutions are pouring trillions into offshore oil and gas and other projects. They loan big money to construct new fleets of fishing boats. Could finance be the bottleneck where we could exert some control about overuse of the sea's resources?
It certainly can be one of them. I don't know if it's the one, but finance has a role to play. And that's because of what you say. It's simply fueling that blue acceleration. To get those graphs going up and to get those trends like, you know, multiplying by like 30 folds over the last 20 years in some cases, and you need a lot of investment and you need a lot of capital. So the idea is, how can we use the financial sector to incentivize better practices and more sustainable practices? And there's been a lot of work done on green finance, or blue finance in that case, with new financial instruments being developed, such as green bonds or blue bonds and so on. And it's interesting and it's valuable, but it represents a really small percentage of the global financial flows. And so one thing we're advocating in the paper is for a transformation of mainstream finance. Like the mainstream traditional financial mechanisms should take into consideration sustainability when it comes to ocean resources. Consider, for instance, a loan from the bank, credit lending. And before giving me the loan, the bank will ask me how much I make every month, what I own, what is my situation, and so on and so on. They will conduct a financial audit. And they do that with companies as well before they want to buy a new fishing boat or build a new offshore platform. Now, they write a contract, which is called a covenant, which stipulates the condition associated to the loan, what the borrower can or cannot do. And right now, it's mostly financial conditions, like such as interest rates or things like that. But if we were to use that tool, which exists and which is used worldwide as the covenant, the agreement between the bank and the borrower, to incorporate sustainability criteria as part of the condition to obtain the credit, this would be really transformative because companies would have to comply with those conditions to obtain the money. And credit lending, like loans from banks, represents more than half of the external financing of corporations on average. So it's colossal, absolutely. That's one example. You can think of the same concept when it comes to stock exchanges, where companies go on if they want to be publicly listed, right, to gain exposure, brand exposure, to raise capital. Then I will go to a stock exchanges and get listed. To get listed on a stock exchange, you need to comply with the listing rules and requirements of this specific stock exchange. And again, this offers an opportunity for finance to play a key role in sustainability by incorporating sustainability requirements of better practices in order to become listed on your stock exchange. And this would be transformative. If you look at the seafood industry, for instance, if you look at the largest 45 publicly listed seafood companies in the world, they are consolidated on only a handful of stock exchanges, like four of them. And the Tokyo Stock Exchange alone concentrates more than 53% of all revenues combined of those largest publicly listed seafood companies. So if you get to change the rules of the Tokyo Stock Exchange alone, you'll have a cascading effect on the seafood industry, for instance.
The United Nations is about to declare a decade of ocean science for sustainable development. Now, personally, I wonder what ocean sustainable development would look like, and I think that we should probably just step back from using the ocean so much. But my real question here is, why doesn't the ocean have its own IPCC, its own institution to track the health of the high seas and make reports regularly like the paper you just published?
There are a lot of efforts across academic institutions and non-academic situations, like civil society groups and so on, that really focuses on the ocean. So, and the interest and the awareness, I believe, is growing. The move by the United Nations to declare that decade of ocean science, I think, goes in that same direction. It's to recognize the importance of the ocean for humanity, but also the timeliness of it in the sense that something is happening, and that's what we empirically show in our study, as a matter of fact, that it's not only starting now, but that it has started for the last 20 to 30 years. So it's really about time we do something about it. Now, all the groups working on climate is no different from the ocean in the sense that it's really interconnected, and the ocean is regulating the climate globally as well. So I think a lot of the work from the IPCC touches upon the ocean, and they released a report on the ocean and poles a few months ago that was really trying to draw a state-of-the-art science for the ocean at the time.
But what about the rest of us? I mean, I feel like we all own a share of the sea. This shouldn't just be a discussion between big governments and multi-billionaire companies. What about the issue of fairness for all the people who are, say, in developing countries who really depend on the sea just to eat?
Yeah, and this is at the heart of ongoing negotiation. Again, the United Nations trying to draw a treaty, a high sea treaty on benefit sharing and access when it comes particularly to access and benefit sharing of marine genetic resources in the areas beyond national jurisdiction, because they are not regulated right now. So anyone can go out there, scoop up something, register a patent on it, and there is no mechanism in place to ensure that, as you said, everyone, every citizen of the world actually would benefit from it. So this is the subject of ongoing negotiations that are expected to come to an end in 2020. For many reasons, 2020 is considered a super year of the ocean, given we are at the onset of the UN Decade of Ocean Science. There is the UN Ocean Conference taking place in Lisbon in June 2020, and there is this ongoing negotiation when it comes to biodiversity in the high seas. So it really is at the heart of it, the question of equity and who is benefiting, or rather not benefiting, from this blue acceleration. A lot of studies have pointed out that whether it's fishing or access to marine genetic resources or the offshore oil and gas industry, it's highly consolidated into the hands of a few corporations or a few economically powerful countries. And that raises a lot of question when it comes to smaller groups of more vulnerable local communities that highly depend on the ocean, including small island developing states, which some of them are becoming large ocean states given their access to the seafloor and to their exclusive economic zone. So all those are dynamics that are being discussed.
We are starting to run out of time, so just two quick questions. Number one, how old were you when you decided to become a scientist?
I was rather young. I think I was below 10, and at the time I wanted to work on forest and water. And I guess I'm still working somehow on water, but it has become a very salty one.
And finally, if all these trends of use and abuse of the ocean keep going straight up, as your study shows, what happens? Could we see a series of collapses like dying coral or the dying Baltic Sea?
Well, it's already happening. So in a way, we're already witnessing dying corals. We already have witnessed dying and very impacted Baltic Sea or the collapse of fish stock. So somehow we've been through that, and we've got a taste of it. Where I'm more optimistic is because I would argue that the awareness for the environmental crisis and the awareness for the need of more sustainable trajectory has never been as high as of today. And that gives me hope, because I think there is a mobilization of citizens, of governments, even if it's a slower going, and of the private sector as well, to actually realize and recognize the emergency and the need to go on a more sustainable trajectory. So we've seen the collapse. It can get worse than what we've seen, but hopefully we'll act on time.
We've been speaking with Jean-Baptiste Jouffre, a bright young scientist working with the Global Economic Dynamics and Biosphere Program at the Royal Swedish Academy and the Stockholm Resilience Center. You can find links to this important scientific report on the Blue Acceleration in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week.